Well, good morning. This is the last Sunday treating particular subjects in our summer series dealing with faith and culture. A very different kind of series for us. We're very committed in Christ our Shepherd to biblical text and teaching and working through text. This has been a slightly different series as we've dealt topically with some key issues that we have to think through and articulate as Christians in the present cultural context, in the public square where we are living and ministering. And we were treated to a wonderful presentation last week from Reagan dealing with the whole issue of civility. The week before, Luke was dealing with a matter of religious civility. We've had Steve talking about faith and science. We've dealt with issues of materialism, sex and marriage and money. Right, if you can remember way back to the beginning, we began the series when I did a very specific presentation on the tremendous call to Christians in our day to think, man, think. Sweat, baby, sweat. To apply our minds to the things of God. And we have paid a huge price for the incipient, ungodly, in fact, worldly, anti-intellectualism that has dominated much of public church life in this nation. The subject that we are dealing with today at the end of this series is sort of part and parcel. It's sort of been referred to in the last two presentations because it's so intertwined with the issues of religious liberty and the matters of civility in public life. And it is the subject of tolerance. I held up last week, the Newsweek last week, Mosque at Ground Zero, and the two highlighted articles sort of talk about topical, speak to the issues. First lead article, entitled A Test of Tolerance by Fareed Zakaria, who's just, since he wrote this, has moved to Time magazine. And the other one, the main article by Lisa Miller, A New Battle Over Religious Liberty, with the outline of Ground Zero in the background. Now, what I'm doing this morning is a little different to how I normally teach. It's probably going to sound to you a little more like a lecture. It's certainly not an exegetical sermon. But there are times, I think, when it behooves us in the context of teaching ministry to not only do exegeting of biblical text, but maybe once in a while do some exegeting of some modernist text, and particularly some of the stuff that is bilged out there by certain groups of people who are very distinctively and unashamedly and dogmatically anti-Christian. And I want to address some of that this morning. Luke and Reagan are hard acts to follow, so I'm really under the gun here this morning. And not to be outdone, I did stoop to do a presentation up here. Okay, so, but I didn't do, I needed help. So I want to thank Emily for putting this together for me. Okay, I'll tell you when to move the slides. Title of what I want to present is Tigers and Terrorists and Tolerance. Let me just first address the title. This year, 2010, began in the press with the ongoing tawdry revelations about what one journalist described as the lubricious private life of Tiger Woods. And it dominated the news at the end of last year, and it's how we came into this year. And on January the 5th, a Washington Post staff writer, Tom Shales, wrote a piece about Britt Hume, the retired Fox anchor, who on a Fox News panel discussion the previous weekend had said these words: "My message to Tiger would be, Tiger, turn," not like William Blake, Tiger Byrne, "Tiger, turn to the Christian faith and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world." Now, he specifically wanted Tiger to accept the quote, "forgiveness and redemption that is offered by the Christian faith." Now, needless to say, Shales completely blasted Hume, but in a very mocking and supercilious manner. Quote, "the most ridiculous remark of the year, sanctimonious busybody, looniness." Hardly comments, may I add, that betray much intellectual analysis on the part of Tom Shales. Michael Gerson, who you probably know as an op-ed contributor, I think, to the Washington Post, Reagan quoted him from something else last week, responded 3 days later with a piece of his own titled Faith, Tolerance, and Tiger. And having at least declared, rightly so, that Hume was wrong for insisting he was not proselytizing, he was proselytizing, Gerson pointed out that the American idea of religious liberty does not forbid proselytization. And the assumption of the critics of Brit Hume is that proselytization is the antonym of tolerance. In other words, to assert the superiority of one's religious views. I mean, we sang a very intolerant song this morning. God is greater. God is stronger. God is higher. Get ready for the lawsuit. Bring it, says Shelley. Now, of course, what Gerson says is it's not merely bad manners. What Shelley says, it's not really bad manners to do what Brit Hume did, but it involves a divisive and offensive judgmentalism. Gerson admits rightly that proselytization can be done wrongly, as in when brainwashing or any form of, you know, trickery or coercion actually violates the idea of a free religious choice based on open discussion and voluntary assent. But Gerson goes on to argue, and I'm quoting, "The American idea of religious liberty does not forbid proselytization. It presupposes it. Free, autonomous individuals not only have the right to hold whatever beliefs they wish, they also have the right to change those beliefs and to persuade others to change as well. Just as there is no political liberty without the right to change one's convictions and one's vote and publicly argue for them, there is no religious liberty without the possibility of conversion and persuasion." Gerson then goes on to recognize that the root of the anger against Hume is because of his religious exclusivity, the idea that his faith is the right one. This, of course, attracts Shale's condemnation that he has, quote, dissed about 500,000 Buddhists on the planet. Let me now quote Gerson. Are you still with me? Okay, you've got to concentrate this morning. I'm sorry, it's going to be dense. "This supposed defense of other religious traditions betrays an unfamiliarity with religion itself. Religious faiths, Christian, Buddhist, Zoroastrian, whatever, generally make claims about the nature of reality that conflict with the claims of other faiths. Attacking Christian religious exclusivity is to attack nearly every vital religious tradition." Let me just say something in parenthesis that I'm going to repeat several times this morning. One of my goals and aims this morning in what I deliver is to encourage you, Christian, to be bold and emboldened in the public square and not simply to be bullied by the dogmas that are daily communicated from political bully platforms or from an elitist media. Are you with me? And unfortunately, many Christians have actually bought in to a secular definition of tolerance. And I want to deal with that this morning in a way that encourages you. My prayer is that you leave here, you know, there's no war cries and but just knowing that you have a sure basis for being who you are in the public square without intimidation. All those in favor? Do we get intimidated? Yeah, of course we do. Where was I? Don't get carried away, Stuart. Stick with the point. Okay. "It is not a scandal to believers that others hold differing beliefs. It's only..." This is a brilliant point. "It's only a scandal to those who are offended by all belief. Though I am not a Buddhist or a Muslim," writes Gerson, "I am not dissed when a Muslim or a Buddhist advocates his views in public." What is interesting, by the way, another parenthesis, is that the more you deal with this material, the more, without having a conspiracy theory or getting all victimized or everything else, the fact is there is a very specific and virulent charge against Christianity in particular in the public square. Hume's critics hold a strange view of pluralism. "For religion to be tolerated, it must be privatized. Not apparently just in governmental settings, but also on television networks. We must have not only a secular state, but also a secular public discourse. And so tolerance, conveniently, is defined as shutting people up with whom secularists disagree. True tolerance consists in engaging deep disagreements respectfully through persuasion, not in banning certain categories of argument and belief from public debate. And Gerson does not end his editorial. He actually can't resist ending without a little warranted riposte to Shales. Quote, he, of course, is engaged in proselytism of his own, for a secular fundamentalism that trivializes and banishes all other faiths. He distributes, it's a brilliant phrase, the sacrament of the sneer. I'm going to use that one a lot. Who in this picture is in fact intolerant? Now, what brings me to this week, well, which brings me to this week, and the news that's been dominating, I've been tracking the news media every day, the Washington Post every day, and there isn't a day, probably for the last, you know, 2 weeks or since the story broke, that the media has not been dominated by the story that's on the front page of Newsweek magazine, The Planned Mosque at Ground Zero. Now, I said that deliberately, and of course, if you were very particular with a particular point of view to convey or defend, you might actually want to take me up on the way I actually just now presented the mosque in that phrase, the planned mosque at Ground Zero. There's a whole discussion about this going on in the press, and I've just used one of what has been listed as 8 possible descriptions of this story and structure. The Associated Press, in fact, ordered its reporters not to use the description that I just used, because they feared it was favored by conservatives and assumed to be the choice of those who felt negatively about the project. Now, don't assume my feelings about it based on me using that phrase. The other possible terms are Cordoba House, Park 51, the Ground Zero Mosque, the Mosque and Community Center near Ground Zero, the Mosque and Community Center in Lower Manhattan, the Mosque nowhere near Ground Zero, the Ground Zero Death Mosque, the Ground Zero discotheque, Obama's mosque. Of course, every different description is actually carefully nuanced. Those who are calling it the Ground Death Mosque and discotheque, of course, are being facetious. They're mocking the whole brouhaha anyway. And they're nuanced. And you know, maybe it's be a very interesting exercise with a sample group from COC to say, which of these do you favor? But why? Discuss your point of view. How did you respond to Luke's argumentation about this and dealing with the issues of religious liberty 2 weeks ago? So I've been gathering just a number of responses, statements, and opinions with this whole subject of tolerance that we are dealing with this morning in mind, just sampling what's typical of the public debate, which we should be engaging as Christians. I mean, clearly, our president finds himself in a battle which journalists are admitting is beyond all stagecraft. In other words, nothing less than a war over the nature of religion and religious priorities in America. That's not me saying that. That's secular journalists saying that. The president, as you know, held an iftar dinner to break the Ramadan fast in the White House. By the way, I have to say this as a Christian, that iftar is not just a meal. It is by definition a religious observance. It is in fact integral as an act of worship, like Eucharist. Can you imagine the uproar if communion was celebrated with the exclusive religious observances of the liturgy in the White House right now? And the president said, and I love the way journalists do this, as they suddenly put in over green salad, organic chicken, and potato leek puree. Quote, over the course of our history, religion has flourished within our borders precisely because Americans have had the right to worship as they choose, including the right to believe in no religion at all. The journalist then comments about what the president implied but did not say, that in America the forces of assimilation or acculturation, as the liberals like to refer to it, and democracy have historically overcome the forces of sectarianism and tribalism. And the writer then explicitly proffers that what we value more than anything else, i.e. more than faith, more than anything else, of course, is being American. In 1790, a letter welcoming newly elected President George Washington, Newport, Rhode Island, on behalf of, quote, the children of the stock of Abraham. Moses Sykes reflected this view. This is 1790. Deprived as we are heretofore have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens, I see the hand of God in the establishment of a government which to bigotry gives no sanction and to persecution no assistance. And it was in reply that George Washington assured the Jewish leader that the birth of the United States meant a new birth of freedom and respect. Quote, it is now no more that toleration is spoken of as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. Washington said this would be a country where, quote, everyone shall sit in safety, biblical image, under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. If Washington's promise remains part of the nation's creed today, it's true that disputes like the one currently involving the New York Mosque test the limits of that tolerance. Let me just, again, just random coming from various angles in what's been happening in the public debate this week. Mother, this is from a mother of a 34-year-old fireman who had one or two pieces of his body identified after 9/11. And she says, if we manage to get it built, referring to the mosque, and can avoid violence in the process, the world can see that we are a towering nation. And I don't know if she used that towering. I don't think it was a deliberate pun. It may have been, but it's a pretty good image. The world will see that we are a towering nation and that we believe in and practice freedom of religion. Now, needless to say, she is not viewed well by many of the families who lost loved ones in the terror. As another father has said who lost his son, when I look over there and see a mosque, it's going to hurt. Which has provoked some interesting statements in the last few days, like this one from Abraham Foxman, director of the Anti-Defamation League, of all places. Their anguish entitles them to positions that others would categorize as irrational or bigoted. Fareed Zakaria, responding to that, the New York Newsweek editor I just referred to, responded, does the anguish of Palestinians entitle them to be anti-Semitic? Or to quote somebody else, does being American mean holding the personal pain of some above the constitutional rights of others? And did not the president say that the Muslims had a constitutional right? Another, a Christian commentator who I'll be referring to more than once this morning, Brad Stetson, speaks of America's penchant for toleration beyond question. But he says that tolerance has always been, quote, circumscribed by some understanding of what was also best for the commonwealth, the health of the social body. In other words, it's not necessarily intolerant to say no. Continuing, he writes, governing bodies at various levels of a deeply pluralistic society like ours have a duty to consider the range of public sensibilities. A given decision affects and not merely reflexively grant the naked exercise of rights upon request. So now we've thrown another whole issue into the pot, which is understanding the relationship of tolerance to issues of public good and public wealth, which is where all the discussion of what a majority thinks, who are the minority, et cetera, and inevitably, that's kind of dangerous ground to charter. Are you still with me? We're just still on the front page here, okay? The director of the Anti-Defamation League, and this has caused a huge stir, of course, basically said, it's the wrong place, find another place, which seems very inconsistent with what the Anti-Defamation League has traditionally stood for. Is Newt Gingrich right? Is it like putting a Nazi sign next to the Holocaust Museum? Yes, say many Holocaust survivors at the moment. Sign held up by a woman at the Landmark Commission hearing in New York. Don't glorify murders of 3,000. No 9/11 Victory Mosque. Another quote from a definitely to the right think tank leader. There should be no mosque near Ground Zero in New York so long as there are no churches or synagogues in Saudi Arabia. Those Islamists who argue for religious toleration are arrogantly dishonest. No Christian or Jew can enter Mecca, and they lecture us about intolerance, no mosque, no self-deception, no surrender. For Newt Gingrich, it's a matter of national security. This is not about one family's tragic loss, obviously referring to the losses of 9/11. This is about the USA, which is under siege by a stealthy jihad and a militaristic jihad, which is violent. Mayor Rudy Giuliani, this is a desecration, religious word. It's not only is exactly the wrong place, but it is supported by an imam who has a record of support for causes that were sympathetic with terrorism. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, speaking in front of the Statue of Liberty with a poll which he knows that the majority of New Yorkers were opposing the mosque. We would betray our values and play into our enemies' hands if we were to treat Muslims differently from anyone else. In fact, to cave to popular sentiment would be to hand a victory to the terrorists, and we should not stand for that. I came across a very interesting comment in reading the paper the other day where one particular... And by the way, this is not a Democratic-Republican issue. I'm not talking about Democrats and Republicans in what I shared this morning. I'm talking about the philosophy people hold. You know, I'm talking about views people hold regardless of party affiliation. But it happened to be one particular Democratic strategist who came up with a great idea to link conservatives and Christians in particular with the Taliban. And suddenly they start appearing in the newspaper, and I've got examples of it, of phrases like the Taliban army of the American right. But it was another one of these strategists who made the comment in the Post this week that the president on the issue of the mosque has got the substance right, but the politics wrong. Think about that. That is classic. Got the substance right, but the politics wrong. Oh, so there's not a consistent unity between the two, right? Sorry to get worked up. I think that the intolerance, quote somebody else, are you still with me? Think, man, think. Think, yeah. I think that the intolerance that we're experiencing right now is that for the first time in a long period of time, since almost the founding of our country, we've actually begun to allow pluralism to surface in our country. So we started to uphold the ideals that our country was founded on, and the people who've been in the dominant position begin to feel like they're under attack. Okay, one last gobbet. Now, all of this is relating to the tolerance issue. The director of the Tolerance Museum in Los Angeles saying tolerance is not a mandate to accept everything. She goes on to say, there are limits to what a civil society should tolerate, and when the human rights and dignities of others are being trampled and denied, that's not acceptable in a country that advocates rights and freedoms and dignity for all. Now, the journalist who was interviewing her and went to the museum there in LA adds at the end of his article, but as the visitor comments reveal, intolerance is in the eye of the beholder. In the museum's tolerance center are four polling stations that allow visitors to weigh in on the provocative topic du jour. On Wednesday, Geft posed the question, is it appropriate to erect a mosque and Islamic community center close to the 9/11 site? The results as of Friday, 37% answered yes and 62% answered no. Now look, I have about 45 minutes to broach a subject that's arguably one of the most important matters of our day, important for Christians to understand and to have intellectual clarity about it in a way that promotes their personal and spiritual confidence in the public square. However, it is a subject that I'm also going to say has been aggressively co-opted by the prevailing ideology of our nation, which I'm going to describe as secular liberalism, which is a belief system whose adherents have redefined the meaning of tolerance and refashioned it to become their weapon for the trumping and trouncing and for the subjugating and subverting of any point of view or any matter of belief that conflicts with their secular liberal dogma. And I'm deliberately using the word dogma because, by and large, its premises and religiously adhered to tenets are no longer open to question or scrutiny without running the risk of being branded as an enemy of the state. And if this sounds like we are closer, at least philosophically, to a camouflaged totalitarianism, then feel free to go and at least look into that possibility. And I could argue the case that one reason that clear-thinking Christians in particular are such threats to this monolithic philosophy is precisely our commitment to argue for the maintenance of an open public square that allows the continuance of rational argument, of reasonable persuasion, and that will protect it for anybody and everybody. And that will dare to challenge the presuppositions of those who are so contemptuous in their attacks on the presuppositions of Christian faith and are fiercely closed to intellectual inspection and argumentation themselves. Now, I need you to understand that the seriousness of the subject matter, what I'm about to sort of dump on you, combined with the brevity of time, will inevitably force me to say some things that are extremely compacted and therefore forceful. And, of course, you know I'm not committed at all to forceful communication. But though they may have some density, dilute it. Go ahead and dilute it with your own discussion, your own thoughts and opinions. It's just important that we realize that in such discussions, hear me, Christian, we can object without being objectionable. We can make legitimate moral judgments without being judgmental. We can contend without being contentious. And we can be discriminating without being discriminatory. Now, don't be bullied into a silence by any who are fraudulently and hypocritically accusing you of such. Now, I'm talking this morning as a Christian-American. And I've decided, actually, that in certain contexts, this is how I'm going to now describe myself. We have all sorts of hyphenated Americans, drawing attention to particular features of identity which need to be recognized. The assumptions about a non-questioning place for Christian faith in this nation as an unquestioned majority persuasion no longer holds good. I would like the same considered response in the public square from secularists as a Christian American that Muslim Americans are asking for, or Hindu Americans, or in the case of Tiger Woods, Buddhist Americans. As every speaker has confessed in this series over this summer, as we sum up, it's hard to present these in limited time. I believe the record for a Sunday presentation is no longer held by me, but by my dear friend Steve, who was clocked in at 1 hour and 43 minutes. And I just want you to say that I have no intention to break that record, though I may, depending on how I get on, give it a last-minute shot. No, don't. Just relax. Inevitably, questions are raised, as have been all summer, that cannot be answered, and points are made that cannot be fully developed. But that's fine, because the idea behind this series is not to give you a packaged point of view or prescriptive answers necessarily, culture and faith for idiots, but to invite you to think yourself biblically and relevantly, inquiringly and purposefully about the challenges that we are facing, that you are facing in the public square. Or should I say, in the ever-diminishing public square. Honey, I shrunk the square. I'm going to suggest that as a good title for a biographical movie of some secular liberals. All right. I really appreciate the passion with which someone like Os Guinness deals with the matter of the need for civility in the public square, given that the future of this republic depends upon it. There's a void out there when it comes to voices in national leadership who can address anything beyond the short term or beyond the immediate soundbite or beyond the necessity to stay well thought of by those with the biggest wallets and the loudest protests. We have to make, communally and nationally, some urgent and serious choices about how we are going to live with our differences and about what it will take for the motto, a pluribus unum, to still retain any meaning in our republic. And as Christians, we have a vested interest, just by virtue of our gospel convictions, to defend, preserve, and help to strengthen the public square of our nation, which makes for our continuing expression and experience of our legitimate freedoms of conscience, of conviction, and of speech, our rightful presence and place in the due processes of community and national life. So please read the book we recommended last week by Oz, The Case for Civility, in which he argues cogently for a cosmopolitan and a civil public square. Next slide. Man, that was just the title slide. It's all right. It does get better. Okay. Now, here's a quote. America is sick of intolerant people and is not going to tolerate them anymore. I've already said that Reagan and Luke have done a great job on religious liberty and civility, and they're hard acts to follow. But let me just give you a quick outline of what I'm going to cover. Okay, next slide. Okay, next slide. Thank you. 3 points. Number one, I'm going to make some comments on then and now. Old version of what was understood by tolerance, what I'm going to describe as a new perversion. Point number two, how and why. How and why did we get to this point where tolerance has changed its meaning? You know, what's meant by the present culture wars? Three, where from here? How then in this context should we then live? Does that make sense? Okay, next slide, number one, then and now. I'm just going to make some comments, jotted down some sort of bones there to guide my communication. First issue, I want to say something about the universality of intolerance. Now, one of the reasons we need to keep talking about tolerance is because we are by our nature intolerant. It's intolerance that demands our need to be tolerant. One way that the subverters of Christian faith seek to further their agenda, particularly within our university education system, is to propagate the idea that Western civilization is distinctive and unique in its intolerance and ethnocentricity. And behind that charge is the necessary debunking of the foundational role of Christianity in the development of Western civilization. This inevitably favors other possible religious persuasions that then get airbrushed, as much as Christianity is tarnished, to look like the hope for future peace. And by the way, the other thing, which I haven't got time to deal with this morning, is a subject on its own, is we live in a tremendous culture of fear right now. Fear causes us to make all sorts of decisions that, because we fear so much, we just really haven't got time or the motivation to think it through clearly, and find ourselves making decisions personally and nationally that really are about self-protection and are just not as moral as they are dressed up to be. However, look, we have to say, as we look over the world, that there is more, for example, to Eastern religion than peaceful cross-legged meditation. India has been ravaged, for example, by the inhumane and violent intolerances of the caste system. There are several people in church this morning who work for an organization that was birthed as a result of the genocide in Rwanda, just one of many tragic evidences of rooted generational and tribal intolerance in the continent of Africa. Despite all the sort of modern mysticizing of Mesoamerican cultures by those who oppose organized religion and want the worship of nature to supplant the worship of divinity, the fact is that cultures like Mayan culture were barbarous in their intolerance. And despite the attempts to sanitize Islam in the public square right now, we equally cannot be ignorant of the organic intolerances of Islam that are blatantly and religiously expressed and enforced in many nations throughout the world. Only yesterday, the Washington Post was dealing with the tremendous fears about the implementation and application of Sharia law in this country. In the United Kingdom, it's way ahead of here, where the Muslim community is demanding the right of rule of its own neighborhoods and city communities, claiming an independence of the British judicial system. One of the lead stories in yesterday's Star section was discussing the responses and feelings of Muslim American students at American University in our city, struggling in how to respond to the debate over the Ground Zero Mosque. Someone raising the question, is a negative response from the American public going to drive them into the arms of terrorist covens in this nation? You know, inevitably that question. Is it going to encourage them to stand and be counted on what is and is not possibly defensible within their own belief system? But of course, everything's up for compromise grabs here in the world that is riddled with fear. We are happy as a nation to consider and pursue another nation as a strategic ally that is arguably the most consistently virulent nation in the world right now in its persecution and prosecution of Christians sometimes in very inhumanitarian ways. And I'm talking about the nation of Saudi Arabia. There is a continuing need to treat the subject of tolerance precisely because man is a fallen creature of intolerance, and wherever humanity is found, so is inhumanity. And so the endless litany of violence and torture and degradation that attends the distinctives and differences and divisions of thought and culture and religion in the world require that we attend to it. So I'm saying, let's not kid ourselves that this is just particularly Western, but equally let's not kid ourselves about the civility of our own present Western democracy, as if we are not guilty of unconscionable intolerance ourselves, that even if not evidently violent, as yet, is nonetheless violating. Tolerance is a history, the history of tolerance. And lest you and I are tempted to just lie down and surrender to the oppression and depression of current intolerances around us, we should at least affirm that in our own civilization's history, there is a long and a proven story about the principled and practiced virtue of toleration. Those who are historians, who chart this history and explain the necessary establishment of tolerance in our public life in the West, will inevitably, in that history, write about someone, for example, like Socrates. And the Socratic method, as we call it, is still vital to our practice of debate. In his essay on democracy, Socrates began with the need for freedom of speech, the first necessary characteristic. And the last of the six that he dealt with was the one that comes behind everything else, was tolerance. But interestingly enough for Socrates, this tolerance is only thought to be complete if it is working for the benefit of the majority, which again touches on that huge subject I've referred to in parenthesis, the necessary relationship between functional tolerance and the good of the community as a whole, not just the individual. It's precisely the privatization of relativism, with its doctrine of personal and private freedom to do whatever, that is necessarily destructive of civil community life. And of course, we have to face the fact, though, that if the majority are relativists, as is increasingly becoming the case, then their definition of relative tolerance will inevitably rule the roost to the suppression and removal of many dissenting voices. Now, most of what we know of Socrates is from his student Plato. And it's one of Plato's students, Aristotle, that then becomes, in this history of tolerance, just in terms of from a non-Christian history, one of the most influential philosophers in developing an ethic of toleration in the West. That's not to say he had everything worked out, as any historian of women's rights or slavery will quickly point out. However, a couple of ideas of his were crucial to giving the call to tolerance and giving tolerance a social authority. First, he argued that there's a human essence. In other words, there's an essential nature to our humanity that transcends time and place. In other words, this is very important, there is a universal ground for human laws, not just ones that subscribe to local particularisms. So understanding this natural law is vital, because to know what are human needs for freedom and knowledge helps serve the public good and the quality of a good life. And of course, Aristotle and his followers set about to answer the question, what is good? And the vision, this vision for society, premised on a belief about the nature of man, gives a truth context for tolerance to function. And it was interesting, it was on the basis of this natural law that Martin Luther King argued so powerfully and cogently against the humanly degrading and distorting injustice of segregation. Just to give you an idea of how different a place we are now, philosophically, in our own time, and therefore an added explanation of how dangerous these times are to the continuing history of Western tolerance. In other words, is the history of tolerance something that we can expect to continue as previously practiced? Many chroniclers, like Brad Stetson, give the example of a philosopher who has affected all of our lives, and particularly impacted my university generation in the 60s. His work, La Nausée, was compulsory reading. The point is that fundamental to his philosophy of existentialism was the contradiction of Aristotle. For Jean-Paul Sartre, existence precedes essence. Now, this is important. I know this sounds like a philosophy lesson, but it's important. In other words, before any implications of this structure agreement about a natural law, about what is commonly assumed amongst human beings, regardless of culture or tribe or nation or anything else, as moral good, we decide who we are, who we want to be, how we want to live, and whatever that construction is takes precedence over anything else that is described by anyone else as essentially human. Life is about authenticating our existence, our identity, on our terms. I mean, this was the stuff and rage of apologetics when I was a student at Cambridge in the 60s. And I used to do something quite naughty. I was a naughty Christian. And I'd get into a lot of these arguments, of course, and you know, I'd have guys come to my room to argue it out. I'd invite them to lunch. You know, we used to call it the Lion's Den, and we all used to get mauled. I came out of it pretty mauled, because you don't have the answer to every question, but it sort of sends you back to inquire and self-criticize and examine your own faith. But I came up with this neat trick for existentialists, you know, who were arguing the relativist thing, and I'd ask them if they wanted a cup of tea. And I put the water on the little gas ring that I had, and I'd let it boil. And when it had boiled, I'd lift it up, and I'd go and hold it over their head. And said, "You want a cup of tea, but I didn't tell you I want something else. Let me talk about my preference. Because one of the ways I authenticate my existence is watching people burn from boiling water. It's just an existential act. I'm sorry. You know, I know it's not what you want. And I know it's not what you like, and I know it doesn't probably fit with the general mores of my illustrious college, but that's where I am right now. I'm sorry. Give me 10 reasons why I shouldn't pour this over your flipping head." Now, that's really probably pushing it. Now, here's the point. Aristotle did not deny human inclination, preference, and development of thought and desire. He just saw these as emanating from something. I mean, he's reaching out. They are trying to get a hold of a creational doctrine. They're trying to get a hold of a meaning for humanity as something more than simply a bundle of combined neurons or chemicals or an awful lot of water. Let me mention a couple of other things. Are you still with me? Or are you just bored out of your head already? Don't get bored out of your head, Christian. We've got to understand this issue in our day in the public square. Are you still with me? I don't care if you're not. Okay, alrighty. I'm intolerant of your carelessness. Okay, alrighty. Okay, guard the doors. Alrighty. Let's go to the next thing when your argument about tolerance is weak. Coercion. Good. All right. But there are another couple of things, very quickly, that Aristotle brought to this history of tolerance. First was the necessary role of a social and political community, simply because humans are wired for community. And it doesn't take great brains to work out that such social relationships are going to require, where there are differences, the cementing mortar of the virtue of tolerance. Second thing, and this is where he's unlike Socrates, who somehow thought that to know the good was enough to do the good. Aristotle argued that virtues like tolerance should be nurtured, could be nurtured, formed, and acquired for personal and public good. What I'm saying is the history of tolerance is a huge and significant intellectual history, proven history. The third group that's important when you study the history of tolerance is the bunch of guys that we know as the Stoics. And, of course, that brings us right up to some interesting New Testament studies, because the Stoics basically believed in a sort of, best way to describe it is a divine mind, which it's a supernatural divine mind. They called it the Logos. Ring any bells? The Logos. And this Logos was present in humanity and manifested in two ways, through reason and through virtue. What the Stoics brought to the discussion about tolerance was to take what was happening in Athens and Rome a little further. This wasn't just a great idea for civilized Greek boys. This had implications for the entire earth, regardless of where somebody lived. And so we have in our language today, don't we, the idea of being what? Stoical. Because what they then argued for were those manifestations of virtue, most notably forbearance. And so they came to be known for the way that they were forbearing and tolerant as they dealt with those points of view that disagreed with their appeal for a global, a universal understanding of virtue. And in particular, tolerance. And they were famous for the way that they took a stand against unjust laws. Where am I going? Where is all this going? It's going to the next point, which is the non-negotiable influence of Christian faith. Christians, we have a huge part in our faith in the existence and the role of tolerance as a virtue in the public square in the West. And so I want to argue the fact, as significant as all those movements are with the greatest philosophers of Western civilization, there was a greater influence, or to use a sort of Narnian phrase, there was a deeper history. Judaism was the old one, and the new one, which overlaps with the Stoics, is Christianity. And the influence of both Old and New Testaments cannot be ignored. Why am I apparently taking time or being laborious on this historical excursus? Because as Christians, again, you should not be bullied by a secularist who thinks they have a handle and inside track and monopoly on what tolerance is all about. The historical practice of tolerance is rooted in the notions of moral responsibility and human sanctity that are integral to our understanding of our God-created lives. The revelation of the law, what is referred to as ethical monotheism, provided a moral charter for both encouraging moral behavior and outlawing immoral conduct. And the prophets of Israel provided the kind of self-criticism that was necessary to maintain virtue and disbar tyranny. The influence of the New Testament story addressed what the philosophers could not, which is the condition of the human heart. Whether in the event of the incarnation, the kingdom teaching of Jesus, the evidences of the power of grace and redemption, the acknowledgement of personal sin, our capacities for evil, consequently the openness to self-examination, the commitment to persuasion and testimony and example, whichever, all of these aspects of Christian faith serve to mature the capacities to be humble about one's own life, to love your enemies, to be tolerant in circumstances that were hostile and antithetical to your faith, even under the threat that they would take your life. Are you still with me? Three people now are. Listen, a feature of those nations that fall under the canopy of Christendom, especially from the 16th century onwards, is the toleration afforded for the practice of all faiths. The particularity of our nation's history here cannot be excised by liberal editors of our history books. As is often pointed out, the fact that Jefferson wanted a seal for the USA that was the children of Israel being led by the cloud and the pillar of fire itself speaks to the fact that there was an open acknowledgement of the Christian tradition that was foundational to the hopes for this new tolerant society, articulated in the groundbreaking words of the First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The Judeo-Christian tradition that informed the worldview of the framers of the Constitution was not given an absolutism. Madison argued against the use of the word toleration in this context and for the phrase free exercise precisely because he brilliantly understood that even toleration could end up implying the acceptance of a prior religious tradition that somebody at some point would argue should be primary. And toleration would then run the risk of degenerating into a condescension toward the people by the establishment. And writing about this, Os Guinness comments, when he, James Madison, succeeded in changing the word tolerance to the words free exercise, he advanced the cause of religious liberty light years. This sturdy distinction between tolerance and free exercise, condescension and civility, lies at the heart of the American experiment. But it also contains a trap. The right to believe anything does not mean anything anyone believes is right. People's right to believe and our duty to respect their right does not mean they are correct in their beliefs and that we have to accept them. And of course, fundamental to the Christian mission is the acknowledgement of a voluntary response to the gospel. Of course, to our shame, the record of the established church or of national Christianity has been blemished and tarnished, and history is riddled with religious wars and acts of war and terror. And we still bear the shame, particularly before Muslims. But equally, it must be said that the number of deaths at the hands of secularist leaders in the 20th century alone outnumber the total deaths of the rest of history in any confrontation that are going to be charged religious intolerance. That does not excuse us, but it does not give the secularist an authority to claim moral supremacy. Secularists do not have the last word on tolerance. And making it look like a recent humanistic invention long overdue after centuries of Christian bigotry, they need to be respectfully but firmly reminded there is a long moral foundation for this virtue. And that, in fact, without that moral foundation, they may not be as virtuously tolerant as they think they are. But more of that in a minute. The meaning of tolerance. So what then has been the understood meaning of tolerance? The English word tolerance comes from the Latin tolerare, which simply means to bear. Basic to the idea is the notion of putting up with, of forbearance. Why is this important? Because basic to the meaning is the idea that the reason we need such forbearance, that such bearing something is needed, is because something is being presented or faced that is in itself actually unbearable, possibly to conscience or even to preference. And this means, very important, the reality of something disagreeable. The fact of a disagreement is built into the notion of tolerance and its function. If you agree with something, then obviously there's no need for tolerance. It's only needed where there is disagreement, where there is divergence of opinion, where there is a division of belief. Now, what follows from this? Let's say together, think, man, think. Think, man, think. Sweat, baby, sweat. What follows from this? The person next to you is sleeping. Slapped him around the face and said, God is here. All right. Intolerance cannot be the same as disagreement. Say that with me. Intolerance cannot be the same as disagreement. Remember that. To express disagreement or dissent in itself cannot be immoral or anti-civic or anti-religious or anti-person or anti-authority. None of these parties may like it or want to hear it or want others to be influenced by what you're saying, but it's not a violation by virtue of simply saying it. It can only be so if it is enacted or expressed in an immoral way, i.e. wrapped around a Molotov cocktail, or in an abortion clinic destroying bomb, or couched in the terms of inflammatory slander. It is not the act of dissent that is immoral. As the moral philosophers have argued well, from whom we have learned, the moral quality of dissent and opposition is determined by the manner of its expression, but also possibly by the content of the expression, if, for example, it relies on misleading, wrong, fraudulent, deceptive, unsubstantiated claims and information. Now, this is crucial. And to quote one moral philosopher, tolerating a religious belief does not involve a half-hearted acceptance or endurance of the belief in itself, but rather it involves acceptance or endurance of someone's holding that belief. One of my questions right now, as we're dealing with the sort of popularization of the new atheists, is why are the self-crowned monarchs of new atheism, Dawkins and Hitchens, not being taken to task for their blatant intolerance? They have zero tolerance for not only anyone who they consider has bought into the great delusion, but they excoriate anyone who's even sympathetic to them, namely anyone who is in fact practicing tolerance towards a believer, even though they do not agree with their faith. The intolerance of Dawkins in particular is directed to the secular tolerant as well. As one non-Christian journalist was wise enough to observe, they condemn not just belief in God, but any possible respect for belief in God. Now look, obviously, I've got to move on and I'm already doomed to a few sound bites now. But before I do, it must be emphasized that tolerance is not a passive response or virtue. It's not about disengagement or refusal to get involved. If we are tolerant to another's freedom of conscience and where that leads them, then none of us can be uncritical of conscience. As Guinness points out, quote, everyone with no exceptions has a right to be wrong. The dictates of conscience are inalienable. On the other hand, This negative freedom of the right to be wrong has to be counterbalanced. For conscience, though inalienable, is not infallible. Clearly, not every one of us can be right on the same issue all the time, given differing viewpoints. And this means that tolerance is going to be active in its pursuit of finding out what is right, in the continuing pursuit of truth. We cannot just be indifferent to wrong or untruth. So to be tolerant is to commit to an active, not passive, an active but humble inquiry of what is right. That includes us, Christians, to agree to take responsibility for our own maturing and developing convictions, our own maturing conscience, by the way, requiring self-examination and self-criticism. The other way that tolerance is active as a virtue is in its encouragement to us to exercise our rights, possibly our duties in some cases, to actively disagree and engage the necessary debate and dialogue with a contrary position. However, this has to be again done with humility and civility. As Christians, our tolerance and the communications it may require of us cannot be inconsistent with the character of Jesus, with the fruits of the Spirit. The last 30 years of public Christian communication in America have been marred by spokespersons who, though they may be technically right in their moral pronouncements and their consequent criticisms of the state, were nonetheless morally wrong in the manner with which they postulated and pontificated and in the presumption which they assumed they were representing us, the church at large. And the combination of insensitivity and arrogance has done incalculable damage to the cause of Christ. The moral majority helped ensure a Christian minority. The new tolerance and intolerance. You still with me? Four more have joined the club. Okay, the new tolerance and intolerance. Here we go. Now I'm getting down to it. So the question arises, have I said anything thus far consistent with the way that the words tolerance and intolerance are most currently used in everyday current parlance? And I want to argue categorically, no. The assumptions that have now wormed their way, their viral way, into the concept of tolerance are so embedded already in public consciousness by the railing and repetitive demagoguery of the secular liberals that what they say it means, imply it means, demand that it means, is almost common accepted, including by many Christians, as the way that it is. And the result is that we've been verbally bludgeoned into a subjugated, suppressed position where to even publicly question such usage of the term would be to invite social ostracism and a sense of illogical moral shame. Let me give you a random definition of tolerance. All I did was I went to Google. I thought I'd just take the first thing I see. I was Googling for any public organizations that present themselves as specializing in issues of tolerance in the public square and what tolerance is all about. Totally random, just took the first one. Almost blindfold. And it was a site called Beyond Intractability. And here is the definition of tolerance. Tolerance is the appreciation of diversity and the ability to live and let others live. Intolerance is the failure to appreciate and respect the opinions and beliefs of another group. Let me read that again. This is where I'm exegeting secular text, right? Tolerance is the appreciation of diversity and the ability to live and let others live. Intolerance is the failure to appreciate and respect the opinions and beliefs of another group. If you're meeting in home groups this week, this would be a great statement to discuss together. You know, have it all out. Evaluate that definition. Think, man. Now look. Look, I said this is random. I'm not witch hunting. It's the honest. It's the first thing I pulled out. But it's interesting what a good example this is, giving clues of the new meaning or the what I'm going to describe as a perversion of the old version meaning of tolerance. Now, how many would you agree that most, if you just read that quickly, most people reading that would say that's cool. Yeah? It's... You know, respect, appreciating, you know, there's different opinions, it's cool, we need tolerance. Okay, let me just exegete three phrases. Now, I'm being nitpicky here, okay? But so what? We need to be nitpicky. Appreciation and respect the practices of.
So let's exegete this postmodernist text. The old version of tolerance is taking a position which chooses, despite real disagreements, to give the right of the other to hold that position and to respect their right to hold it and express it. Agreed? But that is all that is respected. It has nothing, in fact, to do. Tolerance has nothing, in fact, to do with appreciating anything necessarily about a contrary belief or opinion. I don't have to appreciate its process of thought, and I don't have to appreciate its conclusions. This is a good example of the journey that tolerance has taken. The tolerance that recognizes the other's right to have the viewpoint is now asked to respect the viewpoint itself. What began as a position of abiding something, but not accepting something that was objectionable, has morphed. So the words that are most commonly used in definitions of tolerance are appreciating, accepting, and then it morphs to affirming. Then we get to approving, and now we're meant to applaud. Yay, you! Go for it! Go kill yourself! Yay! And of course, if we don't, we are by definition intolerant and have hurt or victimized the other party and may be in for a lawsuit if we're not careful. In other words, look what's happened in the public discourse. To disagree is to mistreat someone. This is another huge subject. This is the whole confusion about who I am in relationship to what I do. God help us if we mistreated them even more by trying to dissuade them of their position, even by rational means, or persuade them to adopt another position. To present the gospel is in a respectful and decent and civil way is not a moral offense, even if someone chooses to find it offensive. Nor is it oppressive. To disagree is neither to be disrespectful, disloyal, mean, or malicious, or all the other things that I am constantly told as a Christian if I speak as a Christian in the public square. And the hyperbole that is employed is cosmically outrageous. That's a joke, by the way. I'm being hyperbolic. Let me quote Stetson. This is good. Listen, there remains no right not to be offended, not to have our views unendorsed, not to hear ideas we do not like or that trouble us in some way. It is not intolerant to fail to affirm another person's opinions about religion, politics, or ethics. It is not intolerant to warn people of a danger you believe they face or to tell them you believe they are flawed and in need of spiritual help. None of these activities can be reasonably described as intolerant in its authentic sense. I was reading in another context another interesting example, U.S. Senate resolution in 1999, supporting religious tolerance toward Muslims. We're getting to a place where we need one towards Christians. Quote, Muslims have been subjected simply because of their faith to acts of discrimination and harassment that all too often have led to hate-inspired violence. That's true. No problem with that. But it goes on to say that any criticism of Islam, though legal, is morally reprehensible. While the Senate acknowledges that individuals and organizations that foster such intolerance create an atmosphere of hatred and fear that divides the nation. This is an interesting discussion in the public square right now because this was not actually aimed at Christians. This was a response from certain senators to a group of analysts who were taking a stand to warn the government and warn the nation about what they feared would be manifestations of violent Islamists. So it wasn't a sort of an anti-Christian thing. And they were branded, these men were branded, or should we say libeled, as intolerant and divisive by the Senate for just raising the concerns. The second phrase I would exegete in this description is diversity. Now look, you've got to be careful about what is conveyed in the use of the word diversity and pluralism. I believe they are good words. I believe in them. I'm for them. And I actually use them a lot in my conversations. But as someone has rightly pointed out, they are sociological terms. They are not philosophical positions. What am I saying? The term itself implies nothing about the merits of any of the diverse elements. Secularists are committed to the presentation of diversity and pluralism as if they were new absolutes. They have become in themselves unquestioned values in their own right. Why? Think, man, think. Because in such a context, with such a definition, nothing is better than any other, or has more veracity or authority than anything else. Everything's the same, equal in worth and inside. There's a huge change happened in our culture where we understood equality as something based on truth and value, which has given way, in fact, for an unquestioning egalitarianism. And this equality and false unity has to be guarded, of course, at all costs, and cannot allow examination of its claims or debate. And should something like Christian truth cause disharmony, which in this context it inevitably will, then it will become the enemy of public order and a cultural falsehood. Listen, as a Christian, the presence of other faiths in a pluralistic context is no threat to my faith. And it doesn't illegitimize the truth claims of Christianity. Diversity and pluralism have become strategic weapons or instruments to subvert moral tradition, and particularly Christian truth at all costs. Is all diversity indeed good? No. It is not, in fact, an unquestioned value. And by the way, this is, again, this is a huge thing for your discussion, illustrative of the way that secularists use buzzwords, not only tolerance, but words like choice, or dare I say it, words like change. The issue is not simply, can you change? With all the self-congratulatory euphoria that may come with it, as we confess our capacities to do so and assume we have the wisdom to know what actually needs to be changed and why. We never talk about that. We then reduce it to a slogan, we can change or pro-choice, and never allow the time, or anyone else the time, or respect to unpack what that actually means beyond its initially deceptive feel-good sounds right response. Change and choice are not in themselves good. It depends on what you choose. It depends what you change from to what. It all depends on the context. And you cannot use these concepts, just throw them around in a vacuum. Third phrase, live and let others live. The long version of live and let live. Hey, look, that is simply a wonderful, compact summary of the classic credo of the relativist. Mamas and the papas. Those of us who were bopping to that. I love the Mamas and the Papas, man. Except they had lines like, go where you want to go. Go where you want to go. No, don't get me into that. Do what you want to do. And do it with whoever you want to do it with. Thanks for nothing, Mama Cass. Now look, what am I right? Obviously, a change in the meaning of tolerance changes the use of intolerance. Or the meaning of intolerance. So to hold a strong belief ends up rendering you, by definition, intolerant. To attempt to persuade another of your opinion is presented as intolerance. To say you know the truth is to declare yourself a bigot, as intolerant, as arrogant. As Bloom said in his book, The Closing of the American Mind, the greatest sin on the American campus right now is not error, but this version of intolerance. And unfortunately, the broad-mindedness of the secularist is not the same as tolerance. And consequently, their accusations about my narrow-mindedness as a Christian is not equitable with intolerance. Trojan horses, Pied Piper's Pharisees. Man, I've got a few minutes. I'm not even going to get through this. Trojan horses, Pied Piper's Pharisees. What am I trying to sum up here? Trojan horses, I'm saying, you don't have to agree with me, you can argue the case, but I'm saying as best as I can that the new tolerance is a Trojan horse. It's sent out into the culture. It's a recognizable social gift. We're familiar with the word. We know we need it. We want it. We know it's important. But little do people know it has been stuffed with a new meaning that is actually hostile to people who are going to oppose the relativistic secularist agenda that it comes out of. And before you know it, stuff has been smuggled into your life. And the term simply becomes a convenient cover for a particular philosophy, for a relativist philosophy. And woe to us if we dare question its orthodoxy. And the process by which certain dogmas become accepted creeps on us as a nation by stealth. And one day we wake up and it's the status quo. And it's happened in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And of course, because it's now a status quo, we are intolerant
if we dare to question it, because now it is in the realm of my rights. It's not necessarily a right because it is right, but because it is legislated. Isn't it strange how those who were worried about the legislating of morality are happening on the same terms to support the legislating of what we would describe as immorality? The new meaning of tolerance is a Trojan horse. Secondly, I'm describing it as a Pied Piper. You know the children's story. I'm summarizing the image that the way that the flute, that is the concept of tolerance, is being played in a way that beguiles those who hear it, follow its beat, and we end up like social lemmings with no brains. Thirdly, Pharisees. And I'm being tough here. I'm referring to the hypocrisy of those who charge others with intolerance as a result of their own dogmatic, unquestioned presuppositions about what life is all about. Secularists, relativists, are as religious as any of the religious they deride, and arguably more fundamentalist than the so-called fundamentalists that they attack and marginalize. They are riddled with moral judgments. They deny moral authority, yet are happy to ride on the back of morality when it suits them in their argument or appeal. They bank on a traditional response when it suits them, whether about issues of race or any number of named issues about justice. They have their own convictions, which they hold and propagate as objectively right, whether abortion or banning Christian symbols in the public square, or same-sex marriage. These are matters of creedal faith, and yet they have the illogically inconsistent nerve to scoff anyone who opposes their claims of their self-evident but self-serving conclusions. Next slide. She's asleep. Next slide. Helen White. Okay, let me fly. Okay, so truth and tolerance. Go back to the message that Bo gave at the beginning. The reason we had truth dealt with at the beginning of the series is because it's the underpinning of everything. The reason the meaning of tolerance has changed is because of a change in perceptions about truth. The creed of secularism is rooted in a belief, and I use the word deliberately, that truth is what you want it to be. Bolstered by the old demons of American pragmatism, truth is what works, add a little bit of spice of rationalist, emotionalist, empiricist, you know, out the spice cupboard, and the bottom line is that subjectivity has become the new absolute of our culture. What is true to me is what matters. I create my own reality, answerable to no one, and any challenge to my view is an unwarranted and intolerant imposition. I deny my creator by being self-made, my desires, my perceptions, my realities. And if there is something I don't want to assent to, especially a moral injunction, and particularly if it has to do with my sexual needs, then the accusation of intolerance is my defense. And again, as one non-Christian political commentator has included, liberal tolerance, if this is how it is presented, is a sham. And the problem, Christians, is that tolerance and truth are dependent on each other. Tolerance, to quote some philosopher, tolerance needs truth in order to be a coherent concept in public life. When truth has been reduced to personal taste or preference, there's no basis left on which to appeal for tolerance, because there's no moral basis for defending the unquestionable value of a human being. Abortion is absolutely the dogma of this belief system. Truth needs a context of tolerance to work. But when truth comes, it brings with it an ethic of tolerance. And as Christians, we should unashamedly point out that Christianity for 2 millennia has been a foundation for public tolerance. And the elbowing, the excising of Christian faith systematically from the public square will inevitably result in a loss of tolerance in public life. The defender of tolerance is being removed from the public square. Secular reason and liberal relativism have no moral authority to command anything. The call for tolerance cannot ask people to go further than their personal preferences will take them. Secular liberalism cannot present an ought. I'm quoting one philosopher, tolerance loose from the moorings of objective truth can only float away into the vast sea of individual preference. So the fragmentation and the demise of this republic will increase, and the Christian understanding of truth will become increasingly counterculture. Why would you be surprised at the increase of hostility? Don't feel hurt because secularists don't applaud your virtue. Thugs and thieves, again, I'm being strong here. Political correctness is a Marxist term. Did you know that? It's a Marxist term. So we shouldn't be surprised that down the road somewhere it might produce a new gulag. Political correctness is opposed to the Christian faith. I'm not into wild conspiracy theories. I've fought them amongst evangelicals all my life. But the systematic, intentional dismantling of Christian foundational ethics in the public square has been brazen. By thugs, I mean the bullying and intimidating tactics used to dominate public discussion, hostile, threatening takeover tactics, commandeering terms on which public discussion will and will not be allowed.
Why should citizenry have to fight to be heard simply because their point of view has already been judged as disagreeing with a decision, especially if manipulated by a minority view? And that's why people are now referring to the tyranny of the minority. By thieves, I am summarizing the wholesale robbery in our culture of a crucial concept like tolerance and other moral words that are then redefined to suit a relativist philosophy, yet harnessing their old suggestive value of moral authority, yet trading in their historical, social, and moral capital. I'm referring to the robbery of the principles that have been provenly effective in the ordering of public life. I'm talking about the robbery of civility and, frankly, the robbery of legitimate rights through threatening bluster. Contempt and rage. This is why we dealt with civility last week. Because these now become not discussion, not debate, not dialogue, not the Socratic method. These become two of the most used weapons against those charged with intolerance. But let me finish my thought here, because I'm not being one-sided. It's not without significance that the most repeated actions of defiance and hatred against Jesus Christ, the ones most referred to in the Gospels, were mocking and scoffing. The sacrament of the sneer, the put-down, the personal attack. It keeps us mocked, marginalized, and mute. I actually have a remarkable love for Bill Moyers. I spend my life liking guys who really mess with my faith. I don't know, I just, every now and again, and the Lord just turns me over. I went through an epiphany last week. Cherie and I were sharing a common experience we had the same week. I went through an epiphany in my heart with Christopher Hitchens. And I had to confess, I told the Lord I was sorry that it took the news of his esophageal cancer to get me to have the emotions that I should have had all along for him. I regard him differently to Dawkins. I haven't got time to sidetrack. I think there is a frightening tenor to Dawkins. I think Hitchens is a sort of blustering cowboy in the philosophical field. But the fact that he has put out in the public that if you hear that I have given my life to God or got right with God or become a Christian from anybody on my deathbed, don't believe it. Why would he be so concerned to say that? Does he fear something? And I started to weep. I was at the dining room table, and I started to weep. And I started to pray for him. I have a real passion. And I thought, I'm going to start writing a letter. I mean, in my head, working out a letter I would write to him to tell him all the reasons why I, as a Christian, would miss him in the public square as a new atheist. I found out that Cherie's already sent the letter. She had the same experience the same week. We both, in fact, I don't know where she is, but we both found ourselves with tears in our eyes as we were swapping our stories. I'm saying that because this is serious life and death stuff. But Bill Moyers, highly intelligent man, very canny comedian, able communicator, has no foibles when it comes to the tactics he uses to demean Christians. His blasphemy is reason to hold your breath. Where the Christian ethic is not treated as having any legitimacy, but, quote, bigoted and inherently flawed. You know, I'm going to read you an R-rated piece here to make the point. I'm not trying to be... This is reality, Christians, reality. Time magazine correspondent. I would be happy to give him, talking about President Clinton, any number of sex acts just to thank him for keeping abortion legal. I think American women would be lining up to show their gratitude for keeping theocracy off our backs. Time magazine. Do you understand why there's a desperate need for recovery of civility? And who does she think she is, speaking for the American woman? But I must say, neither do I approve of the same unconscionable tactics by those who present themselves as defenders of the family or any other Christian institution. I've stopped, in fact, reading the daily bulletins of the Family Research Council because I just got so upset by the resort to smart aleck sarcasm and personal belittling of opponents. Stone me afterwards. There's no need or place, Christians, for either brashness or stupidity at this hour. Some evangelical responses to public issues over the years have looked like a spring break for zealots. Evangelicals gone wild. I must make the movie. And the folly that has resulted from an arrogant arrogant anti-intellectual stance has added to the contempt. That's why you need to go back and listen to Reagan's message of last week or Luke's of the week before. So what I'm saying is the new tolerance, I could argue a case that we better be careful that it doesn't become the old totalitarianism. Because the other manifestation of thuggery worth discussing in this matter of tolerance and its new meaning is the way that attempts are made to coerce a viewpoint in public. We have several examples, say, of Christian student groups shut down or penalized or defunded because they would not agree, for example, to gay leadership. It's interesting that all moral preferences are allowable apart from those of Christians. Of course, the secularists can't be guilty of discrimination. And the ultimate thuggery, of course, is judicial action. Smuggle it into law. Our pride in our democracy is beginning to look naive. Political correctness imposed is but a new totalitarianism. In fact, there is already a new term coined which you're going to come across in the months ahead. It is totalitolerance. It's already been coined, and not by Christians. Which leaves the last slide, then I'll let you go. I'm still inside Steve's record. Okay. Come on. All right. Okay. Where to from here? Where from here? Very quickly. Where to from here? Lunch comes to mind. Okay. Perspective. Let me summarize. Perspective. We need to have a clear perception of what's going on out there and why. We need to be inquiring and investigative, not for the purpose of pulling anything down, but for building it up. We should neither be overwhelmed by the perspective of the new atheists or the new intolerance or the new bigots than we are by many who claim to be God's spokesman in the public square for us, who are equally vitriolic. The rhetoric of many Christians in public is disgraceful. We've had to walk through this as a church, by the way. Posture by posture, I'm simply saying, dear hearts, that in this context of the changing of the meaning of tolerance, of our need to understand what tolerance means, that we're not threatened and bullied by it, that we understand what tolerance requires of us, but what true tolerance does not require of us. Our posture has to be one of humility before God, man. It has to be a posture of consummate patience in the face of any opposition. It has to be a posture of courage in the face of ridicule. It has to be a posture of compassion in the context of unsympathetic and unyielding criticism when the playing field out there is in fact not even. And it's always a one-way street in favor of the detractors of Christianity. Principle by principle, you do the study. There are so many crucial principles of tolerance that need to be understood. Again, another message in itself. I'll throw out a couple for you to think about. The principle of limitation. Toleration, tolerance is never presented as open-ended and limitless. Sometimes there are limits. There do come times when enough is enough. For any number of reasons. When certain things get past a due date. There are times, as we know even in personal areas of tolerance, where intervention becomes necessary. Hypertolerance runs the risk of eventually legitimizing things that end up as possibly evil, like brutality. Another principle that you need to think about is the principle of belief and moral criticism. Tolerance invites you to a confidence in what you believe, but equally a willingness to engage the debate. A critical debate, including taking the knocks yourself. Another principle is this principle of context, which we're battling with nationally right now in terms of the ground zero. Are there limits to tolerance? Are there sensibilities and tolerations we require of others when we are struggling? This is all becoming part of the national debate. Practice by practice, I'm just going to close by reading some scriptures. Just listen to the word. Let your gentleness be evident to all, because the Lord is near. Love is not rude, is not self-seeking, is not easily angered, and it doesn't keep record of wrongs. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and don't curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn, but do not be proud. Do not be conceited. Do not repay evil for evil. And be careful to do what's right in the eyes of everybody. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. In this way, you'll heap burning coals on the head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil by good. Don't repay evil with insult, but with blessing. Because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. Okay, if you have to, rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, that you may be overjoyed. If you are insulted because of the name of Christ, you're blessed. for the Spirit of glory of God rests on you. So then those who suffer according to God's will should commit themselves to their faithful Creator and continue to do good. Dear hearts, the Lord is not slow in keeping His promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you. This is the fundamental part of the ethic of patience and the ethic of tolerance. Not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. Therefore, your patience is absolutely required, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, rooted and established in love. So blessed are you, says Jesus, when people insult you or persecute you or even falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. You know what? In the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. We might say the tolerant and the intolerant, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Persecution sounds like a big word. I'm talking about opposition. It's a biblical issue. Hear the word of Scripture. Remember the words. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted you, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they'll obey yours also. In fact, if you want to live a godly life in Jesus Christ, expect trouble. Thanks for that promise. It's not in a promise box. When you're persecuted in one place, flee to another. Jesus talks about the whens of opposition. But he then talks about the thens of it. Then you'll be handed over to be persecuted. And of course, the issue we're dealing with in the West is the very early days of this, because we are not a culture that is dealing with it in the same ways that Christians and the church are dealing with it in two-thirds of the world. But before all this, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. Another wonderful promise for the promise box. Thank you, Jesus. They will deliver you to synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. So what do? You bless those who persecute you, and you bless and do not curse. We work hard with our hands. When we're cursed, we bless. And when we're persecuted, we endure it. Which is probably a good segue to the last point, that suddenly there are certain characteristics of the Christian that become very, very important in cultural contexts like these, where there is so much disagreement and such a challenge to learn to live and work out lovingly our differences. And that is the characteristic of endurance and perseverance. Hear the word of the Lord. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you receive what He has promised. It's so easy to give up. It is just so easy to be so overwhelmed. I have days pastorally sometimes doing things. I say, look, I am just overwhelmed. One of the ways I've said it to the Lord is I don't know if I should put all my energy into just being with folk who are just struggling to survive and stand, having done all things to stand, who are getting beaten up in the real battle out there, or whether we just leave all of them and just go walk onto the street and spend all your time with those out there. Where do you go? And everywhere you go, it's challenging. And I'm not making a sour mouth, oh, poor us. I don't believe that. Blessed is the man. See, it's all about blessing. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. Not till then. Bad news. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance. You've seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. You have persevered and have endured hardships for my name, and you haven't grown weary. I want to tell you, this is a wearing business. Just thinking is a wearing business. Being in church today is a wearing business. You're going to be really tired this afternoon as a result of being here, and you're going to fall asleep. I guarantee it. And I hope you have a bad dream about intolerance, okay? So that you wake up and saying, ah! Don't buy in to the semantic mysticism of the relativist. Don't buy into it, Christian. You have a history on your side. You have an Old and New Testament on your side. You have empirical evidence of the work of God on your side. And if push comes to shove at the end of the day and somebody is giving you a work over, you just defend yourself, not on the basis of your faith, on the basis of their philosophy. And you look them in the eye and say, let me tell you, I am a Christian American. This is my preference. Get over it. So we should not be averse to using the very grounds of argumentation that are being used today. Use it. You have a right to use it. And if it comes to the day that that's the only thing
that lets us stand and say what we're going to do, then use it. Be wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. As the Bible says, it sounds sort of intolerant. Spoil the Egyptians. It's not because God didn't like Egyptians. Have you noticed how Egypt features in prophecies of what God's yet to do in the earth? But we do need to think, baby. We really do need to think. So I hope you realize you cannot be bamboozled. You can be biblically tolerant. You can be tolerant in terms of your civilization. And don't get bullied by the charges of intolerance that need to be challenged. Amen? Amen. Persevere. Practice your faith with all due diligence. Remain grateful that you're not in a place of besiege as many. Strive for holiness and moral excellence. And remember, at the end of the day, people come to Christ the same way you did. They weren't coerced. It's mainly the brokenness of life and the emotional issues, not the intellectual issues, that keep people from a place of faith. So we need to have a high expectation of the drawing power of the love of God to draw those for whom he died to himself, and they wake up in another country, persuaded that he is able to keep what they have committed to them. Thank you for listening so long, and for your attention through the series. We trust that it was interesting. We trust that it's been a help. Has it been worth doing as a church talking through these issues? And we hope that you are now go with it. Now think, man. Think. Let's pray, and then I'll dismiss you. I'll say grace for the organic food. Lord, I'm reminded, even as I'm about to pray, of those who described your incarnation as the intolerable compliment. We thank you, Father, for the tolerance of divinity. We thank you for the love that pursued us when our argumentation was completely warped. We thank you that while we were still enemies, you loved us. We confess, Lord, we are a people that get stressed and are under duress. We feel, Lord, that the ground we're standing on sometimes is just eroding under our feet. We are broken by the ridicule and the slander and the scurrilous way that even you, Jesus, are talked about. So, Lord, we ask for help. We do not know all we need to know. We're not asking to be smart eggheads, Lord. We're not asking to win an argument. We are asking that through all of this, the wooing love of Christ will continue to draw. We thank you that our faith is rational. We thank you that we can give reasons. I pray you'll continue to equip us with the knowledge of your word, use us in our relationships to cheer each other on in our pursuit of you, to think rightly about things that we're discouraged about. Let tolerance, let this gentleness and respect be a recovered virtue in our lives. And I just add as a PS, Lord, living in a culture of contempt and anger, will you take and unroot out of all of our souls the roots of our own disdain, the roots of our own contempt, and especially the roots of unresolved anger? I just felt to pray that this morning. Lord, we want to be trustworthy instruments in your hands. And I pray for anyone, if anyone is struggling, Lord, with a history of unresolved anger in their life, and even someone I'm praying for this morning who doesn't even know what the object of their anger is. This weight of passive-aggressive we carry around with us, the things that affect us, Lord, you know how it is. But we ask you to come. We're not asking just to mollify. We're asking you to deal with the roots and change us. And we ask for the fruits of the Spirit to be our portion. Bless the food that we're about to have. Thank you for the hands that prepared it. We thank you for the money that's going to be raised. Help us to give generously to support this mission in the Middle East. And may your power continue to be revealed. But as your power is revealed, I pray there'll be no loss of the gifts of your people with open Qurans and open Bibles to persuade of the goodness of God. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And we all said,
Amen.